Today's daf is Kuf Mem Tet. We're going to start at the bottom of Kuf Mem Chet Amubet, Amar Rav Sheshet. Amar Rav Sheshet. Now we're going to have different lishonot of something you could say and would it be considered a matana or not. So it comes Rav Sheshet and he said, if you use the words Yitol, V'yizkeh, V'yachzik, V'yikneh, Kulan Lashon Matanahin. This all is effective, meaning if the Shechiv Mira is sitting on his bed and he said, Yitol, you should take. Yizkeh, you should be zocheh. You should be, what's the word? You should be merit.
Yes.
Torah, you know, you should merit. Yachzik, you should take. Or, you know, you should have a chazakan. V'yikneh, and you should acquire. All of these count as a lashon of matana, which means if he used those word, that wording, he can pass this on as inheritance.
Inheritance or gift?
As a gift. Meaning, right, on your deathbed, I confuse the terms because it is like an inheritance, but yes, like a gift. These all work as a gift. What's really the chiddush of Rav Sheshet? So Rabbeinu Yonah says that the chiddush is that you might have thought that with these words you might have needed to do some sort of kinyan. Okay? That it could be you would have to do a kinyan with the person you were trying to pass it on to. And comes Rav Sheshet and he said, no, these are, because remember, we talked about Lashon Matana specifically, Tnu. So Tnu you would have thought would work. But instead we say, even what Rav Sheshet is saying is, all of these wordings would work. Everything would work as long as, right, even if you don't have a kinyan. Okay? Matznita Tana, in the Braita, this also, it adds, Af Yachasin V'yirat. Even yachasim, what is yachasim? It means yinchal, like nachala. It's even lishonot that sound like inheritance, passing on as inheritance. The yirat, remember taf and shin switch around, yirat is yirash. Okay, so even if you use the words yirash, it doesn't have to be a lashon of necessarily nitina. Okay, even if you have a lashon of yirusha, it would work. Now, obviously, there's a problem with this because what did we say? Remember Tanakama against Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? That according to Tanakama, if you use Lashon of Yerusha, you can't give it to someone who's not Ra'oi L'Yersho. Remember? You can't give it at all, right? You're not allowed to use Lashon Yerusha only if you use Lashon Netina. So they say, obviously, this Braita is B'Ra'oi L'Yersho. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, it obviously holds like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and only in the case where he's Ra'oi L'Yersho, meaning he wants to give it to one of the sons as opposed to the rest of the sons, then also Lashon Yachasin in Yirat would work. But presumably those wouldn't work according to Tanakama. The other thing, one second, there was something else about Rav Sheshet that Lashon Netina. Right, the Rashban adds here that another thing that Rav Sheshet is trying to tell you with Yitol, Yizkeh, Yachzik, Yikneh, is that even if it's Bala Olam, remember we were talking yesterday about Peirot, that where you know Bala Olam, and you can't just say, I'm giving you the schud of the Peirot. What do you have to say? Tnu dekel zeh leperotav. Remember, Tnu bayit zeh ledorbo. So there, what he wants to teach you is, not only do you need the Lashon of Tnu Bayitzeh, this is a possible reading of him, of Rav Sheshet, that not only do you need to use the Lashon of Tnu when it comes to Davar Sheino Bala Olam, like rights to a house or rights to payrot, but even in a Davar Shebala Olam, you still need some sort of Lashon of Nitina, and all these Lashonot would qualify. You told you, it's not just enough to say, this is yours. You'd have to say, right, Yikneh, Yiktol, Yizkeh, Yachzik, Yikneh, something like that. Okay? Ibayilu. Now, if they're already talking about Lishonot at work, what about the following Lishonot? Yehenebahen. You say he should benefit from these. Is benefiting from something mean you're transferring ownership? Or does benefit mean, well, I'll let you benefit from something that I have, but doesn't mean I'm passing on ownership to you? Dinehave. Kulu matana kamar. Does he mean I'm giving this all as a gift to you? If you say you should benefit from this, odilma litane minayu midi kamar. Or does he mean I'm just letting you benefit from it? You can use it, but I'm not passing on ownership. Yera ebehem mahu. You shall be seen in it. Okay, let's say you shall be seen in my house. Does that mean you can come into my house whenever you want, or does that mean I'm actually giving you ownership of my house and therefore you can be seen in it? Ya'amod bahen, you can stand in it, mahu. Yish'an bahen, you can lean on it, mahu. So again, all these words are in-between words, right? The first words we saw were yitol, yizkeh, yachzik, yikneh, yinchal, yirash. They were real words of acquiring. These are all yehaneh, yireh, ya'amod, yishan, yish'an, sorry. It means that you can use them, right? You can lean on them, you can stand in them, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're passing on ownership, and therefore they ask the question, if one were to use those lishonot, mahu? And the answer is teku. Okay. This is all.
It would be very troublesome if it weren't teku.
Why?
Because they're very vague and ambiguous.
They're very vague and ambiguous. You can wonder why they're asking this. Would someone really use these lishonot? On the other hand, again, we're talking about someone on their deathbed, and maybe they're not clearly aware of everything, and they just kind of say some sort of wording, and they weren't paying so much attention. Although, again, we did say yesterday they pay very much attention, and they know exactly what they're doing. On the other hand, maybe one could say. Okay. At what stage in their deathbed are they? Yes. Okay. Keep that in mind for an upcoming story. Ibayilhu, not yet, we're getting there soon. Machar kol nechasav mahu. Now, we had a case where somebody gives away all his nechasim. That was our Mishnah. He gives away everything, divides it up among all sorts of people, and then he dies. Remember, if he leaves over nothing for himself, the assumption is he was only doing that because he thought he was going to die. He didn't leave himself anything. By the way, today we're going to get to how much does he leave over. Remember, the Mishnah said, shiar kolshu, any little bit, which seemed quite strange. We're going to interpret that today. But right now, before we get to that, we're jumping to a case of, what if he sells all of his property? He sells everything. Now remember, generally people wanted possessions, right? That, rather than money. What's the problem with money? Nowadays, you can put money in a bank, even though even banks aren't always so safe, but at least you can put your money somewhere reasonably safe. In those days, if you had a lot of cash on hand, that wasn't necessarily a good thing. It wasn't how you wanted to keep. You'd rather have assets rather than cash. So, machar kol nechasav mahu. What if he sells everything? Okay, do we? And then, and he was sick, he sells all his property on his deathbed, and then he gets better. So now he's got nothing. Can he go back and say, hey, I never meant to sell that to you and leave myself with just cash? Certainly not. So, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, im amad eino chozer. If he gets better, he can't renege. Okay, that sounds reasonable. But then it says something awfully strange. Vizimnin, and other times, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, the same person, said, im amad chozer. If he got better, then he could change his mind, and he could say, I want everything back, I'll give you the money, you give me the item. So that's very strange. How did Rav Yehuda say in the name of Rav, sometimes eno chozer, and sometimes chozer? Okay, I charted this out on the sheet. Velo pligi, and actually there's really no machloket between them. Because they were each, when Rav Yehuda said this in the name of Rav, and he said it in different situations. Ha de itnehu lezuze be'enayhu, ha de parinu bechovo. Okay, let's start with the second case. It's a little easier to understand the first case after you understand the second case. If he took the money and he paid back a loan with the money, and he no longer has the money, then it was obvious that he was selling the possessions in order to pay back a loan. And he doesn't even have the money anymore. Clearly, he wasn't intending to be chozer bo. He was clearly gomer u'machne. Remember, we always have this issue when somebody sells. Is he gomer u'machne? Did he mean this to be definitive? That was the whole thing about the toch kedei dibur. Maybe in the first minute, he actually wasn't 100% sure yet. He kind of agreed to the sale, but then changed his mind a minute later, or a few seconds later. After that, one can assume gomer u'machne. So here also, if he used the cash and he paid back a loan that he owed someone, then clearly he intended for it to be a sale whether or not he got better. But ha de inu lezuze be'enayhu, that's the first case, if, the first case mentioned here, which is actually the second case we saw, if, when Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, im amad chozer, if he gets better, he can be chozer bo, that's if he has all the cash in his hand still. Then we can assume that he was only trying to do that. Again, why would he turn all of his money into his property into cash? We're not exactly sure. But if the cash is still there, we allow him to renege on what he did because we can assume he only did it because he thought he was going to die. Okay, next question. Ibai lehu. Shchiv mera shahoda mahu. If a shchiv mera on his deathbed says, I owe money to so-and-so, do we believe him? Now, why wouldn't we believe him? Obviously, it's not in the interest of his yorshim, for sure, and we're assuming he wants to take care of his yorshim, to say he owes money if he doesn't really owe money, or so we think. But what we don't realize is there's another issue. It comes up in Sanhedrin that Adam asoy shelo lahasbia et banav. People generally might want to lo lahasbia or to savea, that he's satiated. He might want to make it look like his sons don't have a lot of money. Now, why would he want to do that? There's various reasons given. The main reason given is he doesn't want an ayin hara coming upon them. He doesn't want people to look and say, oh, look, this wealthy person died. And look, he left all this money to his children. Immediately, that's going to bring an ayin hara. You can also imagine, at a time of a person's death, people will talk about it more than when he's alive. Because when he's alive, it's just, they're used to it. But when he dies, everybody starts talking about the person. They're going to say, oh, look at the big, you know, whatever he left over. So a person might want to say on his deathbed, I owe lots of money to so-and-so, just to make it look like he doesn't have a lot of money, and therefore not cause an ayin hara to come upon his children. Another thing could be that if he looks like he has a lot of money, people might come to ask for loans and other sort of things, and better to look like you don't have money than to have people pounding on your doors for loans and things like that. You know, again, a protection for his sons. So you might want to say on the one hand he wants to protect his sons and not make them pay out all this money. On the other hand, he might just be saying this in order to make it look like he doesn't have a lot of money. So, therefore, how do we treat the hoda'ah v'shchiv mera? Do we believe him? Or are we choshesh for this concept of shelo lasbiat bana? So we're going to learn it from a story. The story has a bunch of, I would say, troubling aspects to it. We'll point out a few of them along the way. I don't actually have good answers for them. Okay, Tashma, here's the story. Only at the end of the story will we see that eventually, I'll already give you it, we're going to see a shchiv mera, and in the end he makes a hoda'ah, and it's accepted. So therefore, he says he owes someone money, and we accept that, and therefore we see that a shchiv mera shehoda, I'm actually telling you the end so that you don't get lost in the details and remember what we're up to. So we're basically going to show in the story, there was the shchiv mera, his name was Isur, he was a ger, and Isur made a hoda'ah that he owed money to someone on his deathbed, and we accepted it. What's going to be interesting about it is it turns out the person he claims he owed money to was his son, and he did it in order so that his son could inherit his property, because we have an issue when someone's a ger. Okay, I'm going to get into all the details before we start reading it inside. Someone's a ger, and once they convert, they have a child, and they, let's say, conceive, because it's going to depend on conception and birth. If the child is conceived after he's a ger, then his son is his full-fledged son for inheritance purposes. We've already learned this. But if someone is born or even conceived before the person converted, then he's not considered his son for purposes of inheritance. So Esau was a ger. He married the daughter of Shmuel. But when he married her, he wasn't a ger yet. And when she conceived, he wasn't a ger. And then he converted while his wife was pregnant. And then when she gave birth, he was already a ger. So in that case, his son doesn't inherit because his horato, we're going to see, his conception was before when he was still non-Jew. So Tashma, di Isur giyora hava, Isur the ger, he was a ger. Let's read it better. Isur giyora, and it's Isur the ger, hava le tracer alfe zuze be rava. He had 12,000 zuzim, that is not a small amount of money as we know. 12, right, I always compare it to the amount in the ketubah, which is valued at a pretty decent amount of money, and that's 200 zuzim. So we had 12,000 zuzim that he gave to Rava to watch over for him, pikadon. Okay, he gave him to watch his money. It wasn't a loan, it was a pikadon. Rav Meri Berei, okay, Rav Meri his son, by the way, he's called Rav Meri the son of Rachel. Rachel was the daughter of Shmuel. Because he was conceived when Esau was still non-Jewish, so they call him by his mother's name often. Here it just says Rav Meri his son, because for the purposes of this Gemara, you need to know he was his son. Horato shelo b'kdusha v'leidato b'kdusha havai. Okay, so again, his conception was shelo b'kdusha, meaning his father wasn't yet converted. V'leidato was after the conversion. Now here's a very strange line. Ubei rav hava. Okay, so some people say this means he was a Talmid Chacham. Which, okay, why they're telling us this, we don't really know, but telling us it's Talmid Chacham. But the general interpretation is Rav Meri. Oh. But the general interpretation is Rav Meri at the time when Esau was a Shchiv Mera on his deathbed was Bei Rav Hava. He was in the house of Rav, meaning He was in the Beit Midrash, okay, which already sends you some sort of weird signal. It's his son. However, again, I don't have an interpretation for this, but I did notice this when I was reading the story. Normally, if your father's on his deathbed, the children all gather around, right? And Rav Meir happens to be in the Beit Midrash. Now, we'll see why it's important that he was in the Beit Midrash for the purposes of the story. Again, if you accept this version, that what this means is he was in the Beit Midrash and not he was a Talmid Chacham. Okay, the assumption is he was in the Beit Midrash at the time, which again, there's going to be two behaviors here that seem a little odd. Again, I don't know yet how they affect our reading of the story, but it's an interesting point, that side point coming out here, that the son, again, wasn't his Yoresh son, his son who was supposed to inherit, but his son was not around at the time he was on his deathbed. Amar Rava, Heichin nikninu Rav Meir lahane zuze. How on earth, Rava says to him, is Rav Meir going to get these zuzim that are in my possession right now? Because what happens? If he's a ger and he has no yorshim, which is the case, what will happen to his possessions? As soon as he dies, they become hefker. As soon as they're hefker, well, where are they? They're in Rava's house. Rava will say, hey, they're mine. Right? He's got first dibs on it. They're in his house. So Rava's basically, now this is the second strange behavior, even though you don't realize this at the time, but as the story goes on, it's going to be clear. When he says, Heche nechninu Rav Meir lahane zuze, he's actually talking, it's a rhetorical question. And what he really means is, Rav Meir has no way to get this money, and therefore, I'm in the money. Okay? Which is quite strange, because we know Rava, and this is not exactly behavior one would expect of Rava. I'll tell you one interpretation I saw, which I really don't think is the pshat, but I'll bring it to you anyway, which kind of is trying to show him in a positive light. What he was trying to do was really a good thing. But in any case, it seems quite strange. What does Rava say? Now, again, you might connect this with Rav Meir was in the Beit Midrash at the time his father was on his deathbed, and maybe you'll say, maybe Rav Meir and his father didn't have a great relationship as it was. And number one, logically speaking, you know, from halachically speaking, he's not supposed to inherit from him. And therefore, why should Rav Meir have any more rights to the money than Rava does, really? Because, you know, maybe Rav Meir, who's not even going to his father and showing the proper kibbutz av, maybe he shouldn't even be zoche. Maybe that could be why they're telling you he was in the Beit Midrash, and therefore, maybe because of that, Rav intuited, maybe there's really not such a great relationship here, and maybe I can just get this money. So now he's going to go through, okay, I charted this out also, all the different possibilities, okay, so if it helps you to view it that way, you can look on the chart. Here's all the possibilities he says, and now, and he's going to explain why Rav Meir has no possible way to get this money. Ibi Yerusha, if you want to say he can inherit it, well, we know already, Lav Bat Yerushahu, right, he can't possibly because he's not a Yoresh by Halacha. Ibi Matana, what if he gives it as a gift, right? Remember, we said a person can on his deathbed give as a gift, even according to Rabbanan, can get right against Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, you know, it's even according to both Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka and Chachamim. If he gives it, b'lashon matana, he can give it to anybody. But guess what? We're going to learn something new. Matnat shchiv mera ki yerusha shavyua Rabbanan. When the Rabbanan instituted that a manat shchiv mera is kichtuv mechmesurin dame, remember, it was a whole takana that they instituted so the person not be worked up on his deathbed, it was only kol hecha de'ite b'yerusha, ite b'matana. Kol hecha de'leite b'yerusha, leite b'matana. It's only if, now it's again a big question exactly who this is referring to, that's ite b'yerusha. Could be referring to as long as Isar is able to be morish to someone, which he's not, because he's a ger and he has no yorshim, so he can't actually pass anything in inheritance. So therefore, if he can't pass anything in inheritance, therefore he also can't give a matana. Because when the rabbis institute, now you could say very simply, when the rabbis institute takanot, they do it in what we call a mikre de shachir, a common case. Generally, we don't make takanot, we see this very often, in a case that's very rare. It's very rare that we have a case where there's no, a person can't be morish to someone. Almost everybody's got a relative, unless he's a ger, because you can always go all the way back to Avraham Avinu, right? So therefore, we say here, this is a case where he's late to be Yerusha, and therefore his matana is also invalid. In other words, the takana, the shchiv meira, can give a matana on his deathbed, is only someone who can actually be morish.
Well, they don't hold like that, though, do they? Like, they didn't actually hold like that, because that would be a terrible thing. Who would want to be a ger?
So, right, well, it sounds like, in this case, that you actually can, that this is actually true. that you can't give your stuff as a matana. Now, it could be that what we're talking about here is a matanat shechiv meira. He could have done a kinyan and passed it on to him, which we're going to get to. In other words, here we're just saying the matanat shechiv meira, where somebody says, I'm giving you a gift on my deathbed, and he doesn't write it down, he doesn't do a kinyan, that doesn't work. Now, if he did an actual kinyan, it would work. We're going to see why he can't do a kinyan in this case. This particular case, there's no option for kinyan.
So
we're going to get to that.
We've been learning in the last week or so about matanot shechiv meira. Nobody, up until now, nobody has limited it to somebody who is bar yerusha.
Right. But again, like I said, if you assume that what we mean by bar yerusha means that that basically we're eliminating a ger, so right, if it's only eliminating a ger, then it's then it seems. Which it seems like it's saying. It seems like it's only really limiting a ger. So if it's only limiting a ger, it shouldn't bother us so much. How many people are gerim, right? They were talking about general halacha. They don't always get into all the details.
That you can't, but if it's a general statement that you can't give a matanat shechiv meira to whoever's standing there that you decide to give.
No, you can give it to whoever you want. It's saying someone who's not bar yerusha, right? It means someone who can't be morish. Right? It doesn't mean that you can't give it to someone who... Right.
Connected to you.
Right. I don't think anyone explains it that way.
It's still limiting it, though. It's a new limit.
By excluding a ger?
Mm-hmm.
Gerim is a problem.
Right. It's a problem of excluding gerim. Look, there's a whole thing... Right. We saw this case, actually, where I think we saw this before, that there's some case where you can't... There's a sugya... One second. There's a sugya that relates to a ger, and they say that there's one case where they allow, right, there's a whole thing about if you give your nechasim to your sons who really weren't your sons because you converted, let's say you converted with your children, so that the rabbis say you actually shouldn't give your nechasim to your son, anyone who does is not a good thing, and then they say, no, dafka, you should, there's a debate about it, I don't remember all the details, but there's dafka ti'un that says that you should give it to the kids because otherwise the kids will want to leave. If the kids actually converted, right, they say this whole sugya is not relevant to this because this wasn't a case where the kid converted. The kid was already Jewish. But if the kid converts with the father and you don't let the kid have the Yerusha, the kid's going to want to leave the religion after he already converted because, like, it's going to be a turnoff to gerim. So because of that, they institute something there. But that's a little different than this case because he actually wasn't a ger at this time. First of all, his mother was Jewish. He just isn't considered the biological father for purposes of Yerusha. He is the biological father. I shouldn't maybe say biological father, but in terms of Yerusha, he's not the father. Okay, so now that's the second option. We can't do that. Even Mishicha, what about a kinyan, right? Because remember, Manat Shechiv Meira is without a kinyan. What if he did a kinyan Mishicha? Well, he can't do that because he's lying on his deathbed, and you'd have to do a kinyan mishicha of the money. Litnehu gabe. The money's not in front of him. The money's in Rava's house. Ibechalipim. What if he does a symbolic kinyan? We know this, right? Where you can pick up a handkerchief. Right? We do this many times. You pick up a handkerchief as symbolic. But we know that ein matbea nikne bechalipim. You can't acquire money through a kinyan chalipim. Going back to what we learned, right, about all the different what you can acquire through various methods, you cannot use chalipim for matbea, for money. I agav karka, remember you can be kone kesef by, he can say, I'm giving, right, what could he do on his deathbed? He could say to Rav Mary, I'm giving you a small teeny piece of land, and with that land you will acquire the money. Ah, but lele ara, he happened to not have any land. I b'mamad shloshtan, what did we learn yesterday? That you could say, mana libiyadcha tnei leploni. That was a loan, but you could do the same thing if it was a pikadon. You could say in front of Rava and Rav Mary, he could say, listen, Rava, there's money of mine in your hands. Give it to Rav Mary instead of back to me. Okay, so first of all, Rav Mary was at the Beit Midrash, but let's say he calls Rav Mary back in and he calls Rava. So what does Rava say? Here's where you see Rava's real motivation. Ishalach leilo azilna. If he calls for me, I just won't show up. And if I don't show up, then he can't do b'mamad shloshtan. And it only works if it's b'mamad shloshtan.
Why not get another third person?
No, b'mamad shloshtan means it has to be the three people who are involved. You, the person you're giving it to, and the person you're... owes you the money, or in this case, it's a picadon that you gave him.
You could make a defense of him saying that he knew about the bad relationship and he was trying to...
I made that up, that there's a bad relationship. In other words, I don't know that that's true, there was a bad relationship. Look, there's two possibilities. One is there really was a bad relationship and this proves it, the fact that Rav Meir was in the Beit Midrash. The second option is to say, I didn't do a historical background check on them to see if we know any other stories about them, which would be a good way to go. But even if, let's say, they had a good relationship, who's to say that Rava knows that? And Rava looks and sees Rav Meir in the Beit Midrash and says, something's wrong. Right? And then very often we look at people and assume, right? It's very greedy of Rava, and that's why Rava, it's quite strange here. I'll already give you the other interpretation, and I think it's Rabbi Yonatan Miluniel. Yeah, he says that what Rava really wanted to do was an act of chesed. What did he want to do? He wanted to be zochet in the money and then give it to Rav Meir. And he was upset that he lost the opportunity to do that. Now, you could sort of laugh and say, what do you mean? That doesn't sound like what's going on. On the other hand, maybe he also wanted, this is obviously a problem with Gerim and their children, and maybe he wanted to make a public display of it to show people this is what one should do in this situation in order to teach people. So that's where one can be melamed zchud on Rava and explain a possible way. I'm still not sure it's the pshat. Again, I think...
It's not random that he left it at Rava's house. He probably assumed that Rava would do the right thing with it. He didn't leave it at some random person's house.
Right. Right, he did leave it at Rava's house. It actually is a little similar. Right now, it made me think of the story of the person who left his money to Yonatan ben Uziel. He didn't want to give it to his sons, he gave it to Yonatan ben Uziel, but then what he was hoping, at least in one of the interpretations, was that Yonatan ben Uziel would actually, give it to his sons. And so maybe there's this concept, like Donna's saying, it was give it to this important rabbi because he'll know what to do with it. So the fact that Rava maybe really doesn't, right, again, like I said, there's two underlying things here that seem to not fit in, which is Rav Meir's behavior, that he's not at his father's deathbed, and Rava's behavior, that he's trying to get the money away from Rav Meir and keep it for himself. So again, whether one can explain these things in a particular way, maybe, and maybe Rav Meir was in the Beit Midrash because he was trying to figure out, how can I get this money? Because in the end, that's, at least in some reading of this story, again, it's not so clear what happens here, that we don't exactly tell you all the details, but it seems like Rav Meir was here when this discussion happened. We'll see soon they're going to bring a solution, and he brings it back to his father. Okay, it's not explicit in the text, but it's implicit that that's what happened. So it could be he was actually in the Beit Midrash. Maybe his father sent him to the Beit Midrash. Maybe his father sent him there to try to figure out how to resolve this issue before he dies. So that's a zchut to Rav Meir. So there's a lot of things unclear here, what everybody's motivation is. Which maybe isn't, you know, if you think about it now, you have these two facts in a story that are quite strange. Him being in the Beit Midrash and Rav trying to get the money. And again, what's our whole topic of this Mishnah? Umdina, trying to figure out what people are thinking in their minds. And maybe that's what the story is particularly not giving you all the details, so that you realize that sometimes in order to understand something, you have to try to guess what's going through the minds of the people. Okay, Matkifla Rav Ikabire de Rav Ami. So, interestingly, especially if Rav was really trying to keep this money to himself, you'd think he was talking all to himself. But he happened to be raising this issue out loud, which makes it all the more strange. Again, maybe thinking maybe he really did have some good motivation, because otherwise why would he be talking about this out loud in the Beit Midrash? It would be a little embarrassing for him. So, Rav Ikabire de Rav Ami says to him, Amai, velo de isur dehalin zuze de Rav Meir ninhu. What was our whole question about a hoda'ah? Can't Rav Meir just say, Isur, just say on his deathbed, I have money, this 12,000 shekel that's in Rav's hands, but really I owe it to Rav Meir. Okay, can't he just say that? That would be a hoda'ah, and a hoda'ah shchiv meira. Now we see, according to what, right, we asked the question before this, from this story you can see, the hoda'ah shchiv meira works. Because comes Rabbi Ika, Bered Rabbi Ami, and he says he can do a hoda'ah, and that should work, and that way Rabbi Meir will be kone the money.
That's
okay?
In a way, he's bequeathing it.
But he's not, because there's no laws of Yerusha. So what's he saying? And it's true that it's not really that he owes him the money, but by him saying he owes him the money, we believe him. It's a believable statement. So even though you're right, it's not actually the truth in this case. So what do they say? V'lo de Yisra dehalin zuzei de Rav Meir ninhu, v'lekininu be'odita, and then he can be koneh through the hoda'ah, And that's how Rav Meir could get the money. So now, this is why I said it's not exactly clear what happened. If Rav Meir was in the Beit Midrash, we can assume, read between the lines, Rav Meir went and told this to his father. Adahachi, in the meanwhile, Nafik Odita mi Beit Yisro. They specifically don't tell us how exactly it happened. Right, we can just kind of fill in the details in our minds. But a hoda'ah came out of the house of Yisro. Meaning, Yisro basically said, I have money at Rav's house that really is owed to Rav Meir. And Rav Meir got the money. Ikpi Rava, Rava got upset. Amar, kamigmere ta'anta le'in she'u mafsidile. He says, you're teaching ta'anot to people and causing me a hefsed. Now again, what does hefsed mean? Either hefsed means financial loss, because I wanted to get that money, or hefsed means you were the opportunity, exactly. You made me miss an opportunity, either, number one, to do a big chesed, to actually give them the money myself, or, number two, to teach people how to treat sons of Gerim. Okay, that's the end of that question and answer. Next question. Shir karko koshu matanato kayemet. So now we go back to the Mishnah. If he leaves over some sort of karka, any sort of karka, he's matanai's kayemet. So now we're going to debate, we're going to sort of explain two things. Number one, when we say karka, do we mean really only karka? And number two, when we say kolshu, do we really mean kolshu? What does kolshu mean? Teeny bit, right? One pruta, it sounds like. So, vikama kolshu. It's unfathomable to the Gemara that it would mean a shekel, because what's the poor or a pruta? Right? What's the point? The point is that he left over enough room to live on. So a kolshu shouldn't really work. So, kama kolshu, amarav yudah, amarav, karka kede parnasato. He leaves himself enough karka that he can support himself on it. Obviously, you know, question is support for how long, but let's just assume he can support himself, right? Especially karka, one can support, again, even metaltalin, depending on what it is. It's something he could rent out, he could, you know, if it's metaltalin, let's say, if it's karka, he could grow crops on it and have sustenance. Rav Yirmiyah Ba'ar Ma'amar, mitaltalin kedei parnasato. It's not only karka, it's even mitaltalin, movable items. As long as it's enough that he can support himself on it. So now we see that the Mishnah is not explained kipshuta, right? So comes Rabbi Zera and he says, Amar Rabbi Zera, kama v'chubanim shmatita desabe. How wise are those rabbis who said those things? So he views this, by the way, not as a machloket, but the Rav Yehuda and Rav Yirmiyah were both basically agreeing with each other. They were bringing different possibilities. And he says these are both good options. And why does he think it's very precise what they said? Because karka tamamai, what's the reason? Why, if he leaves up a karka kolshu, di'ikai samachale, that if he lives, he'll have what to live by. And therefore, right, that's why we allow the matanot to be considered matanot, and he's left with whatever he can live on. Metaltalinami. Metaltalin also ikai samachilavaihu. Right? If metaltalin, if he has kede pranasato, that would be enough. So what's the difference whether it's karka or metaltalin? So he basically says, when the Mishnah says karka, it doesn't mean karka, it means also metaltalin. Right? In other words, that's what Rav Yirmiyah said and supported by Rabbi Zera. And the second thing he says is kolshu, right? Both based on Rav Yirmiyah and Rav Yehuda. Kolshu is actually kedei parnasato. It's not our general kolshu that we think of. So that's Rabbi Zeri. He says, I like what they said. I think it's great. Matki flar Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef says, what do you mean you think it's great what they said? Umay kavanata. Why do you think this is so precise? That word means precise. Manda amar metaltalin. Karkatnan. Look at the words of the Mishnah. If you want to say it's metaltalin, it says karka. And Manda Amar, which is actually both of them, Kedei Parnasato, right? Both of them said Karka Kedei Parnasato or Metaltalin Kedei Parnasato. Kolshu Tznan, it says Kolshu. So Rav Yosef says, you think this is so precise? It goes directly against what it says in the Mishnah. So Amarle Abaye, Abaye is not concerned with the Kedei Parnasato. What he's really dealing with is the Karka issue. And what Abaye is going to say is based on a bunch of Mishnayot in Pe'ah. He's going to say that we see by this Mishnayot in Pe'ah that sometimes it says karka, and it also means metaltalin. So he wants to say that our Mishnah also must be one of those cases where just because it says karka, it doesn't necessarily mean karka, it also can mean metaltalin. Okay, here goes. So now to do this, we're going to read, I brought you the three Mishnayot. Okay, we're starting with the last one, and then they're going to make references back to the earlier three. So Maybe we'll even just read through the Mishnayot first. Okay? If you look at Masechet Pe'ah, Perek Gimel Mishnah Vav, Rabbi Akiva Amar, Karka Kolshu Chayevet BePe'ah UbeBikurim. Okay? If you have any sort of karka, you're already chayev in Pe'ah, you're already chayev in Bikurim. Bilich Tavalav Prizbol, in order to write a Prizbol, in order to cancel out, not have Shemitah cancel out a loan, you have to have some land. That's another one of those cases where they made a takana only in a case that's shachiach, and generally people who don't have land don't give out money, or don't borrow, right, it's also borrowing money. I think, v'liknot imo nechasim she'en lemachrayu b'kesef b'shtar b'chazakah. Okay, if you have karka kol shehu, and you want to purchase it, right, so you need, l'knot imo nechasim she'en lemachrayu b'kesef b'shtar b'chazakah, right, you can acquire through karka kol shehu other things. Hakotev nechasav, Shchiv Mera, Shier Karka Koshu Matanato Matana. This is our case, right? If you write your Nechasim and you leave over Karka Koshu Matanato Matana, Lo Shier Karka Koshu E Matanato Matana. Hakotev Nechasav Lebanav, Vikatav Lishto Karka Koshu. We learned this a number of Dapim ago. If you write your Nechasim and you divide it all among your sons, and you write your wife and you say, I'm giving you a piece of Karka, even a small piece of Karka, Ibdak tubata. Remember, she gives up her rights to her ketubah. The assumption is when she accepts that property, she accepts it instead of her ketubah. Rabbi Yossi Omer, im kibla alea, afa pisha lo katavla, abdak tubata. Even if she accepted it, even if he didn't write it, she also lost her ketubah. Because the first one said katav. Okay, we're not going to get into the details exactly. Hakotev nechasav la'avdo. This is also something we saw in the past, I think a while ago. Somebody who writes his nechasim to his eved. He says, I'm giving my eved all my property. Now, what's the issue? The eved is an eved knani, and the eved knani is part of the property. So if he writes his eved and says, I'm giving you all my property, what's the assumption? He's letting him go free, because he's saying, I'm giving you yourself also. Okay? Yatza ben chorin, so he becomes free. But shir karka koshu lo yatza ben chorin. If he leaves over a small amount of land, he says, I'm giving you everything except a small piece of land. We're assuming that in that land that he kept, he was also, here we're going to see already, karka doesn't necessarily mean only karka, it could mean also avadim. So if he says, I'm leaving over a little bit of land, it could also mean I'm leaving over a little bit of you, which means you're not free. Rabbi Shimon Omer, la'olam ben chorin. No, even if he leaves up a karka koshu, he's still a ben chorin. Ad Shiomar, unless he says like this, if he says, Hare kol nechasai netunin le'ish ploni avdi, chutz me'achar ribo shebehen. I'm giving my Eved everything I own except for 1/600,000th of what I own. Okay, now the assumption is either he's just mizalzelbo and he's saying, except for my measly little Eved, and says, I'm giving you everything except for you. Okay, or he means, I'm giving you everything except 1/600,000th of everything, basically, which means I own still a teeny part of you. Which means if I own a teeny part of you, then you can't go free because I own a teeny part of you. So it's like I'm giving you a share in everything, but I'm keeping one little share of everything to myself, which is going to include you. So
wait,
now.
So because you learned that an Eved could be like Mekarkin.
So we're not there yet. Hold off. So now the Gemara is going to say like this. So Abaye says to Rav Yosef, Amar le Abaye, b'chol hefi detani karka, karka dafka. You think every time it says karka, it really means karka, v'hatnan. So now we're going to start with the last mission. Hakotev kol nechasav lavdo yatza ben chorin. Shier karka kol shu, he leaves over any karka, lo yatza ben chorin. Now we've seen that karka could include avadim. Right? So here, it's including the Eved. Rabbi Shimon omer lo olamu ben chorin ad shemar kol nechasai netun leploni avdi, chutz mecha ribo shebehen. But that's not enough yet to prove it, because again, avadim and karka are often the same. But on this Mishnah, Amar Rav Dimi Bar Yosef, Amar Rav Elazar, Asu Metaltalin Shir Eitzel Eved, but Lo Asu Metaltalin Shir Eitzel Ketuba. What did Rav Dimi Bar Yosef say in the Rav Elazar? That not only if you're Shir Karka Kol Shehu according to Tanakama, but even if you're Shir Metaltalin Kol Shehu, that will also not free the Eved. Okay? So in other words, what Rav Dimi says, Rav Dimi himself is saying, in the name of Rabbi Elazar, that when the Mishnah says karka, it means karka or metaltalin. So therefore, we see that we have a precedent to saying that karka doesn't always mean metaltalin, not only as a precedent, but as you noticed, Mishnah Zayin was dafka our case. So the Mishnah right near it was also says karka, we can assume it also means metaltalin. But what do they say? Belo asu metaltalin shir etzel ketubah. But it doesn't work when it comes to ketubah. I assume, by the way, why doesn't it work when it comes to ketubah? Because remember, the woman always gets karka. She's gova from the karka for her ketubah. So therefore, maybe when it comes to the ketubah, it says karka, it really means karka there. That only if she gets karka will that be in place of her ketubah. If she gets metalta, then it won't be in place of her ketubah. Okay, we'll just end with one more line. Now they answer, Rav Yosef says, no, you can't prove it from there. Why not? Because hatam bidinu delo litni karka. Really, in that Mishnah, it didn't need to say karka. It should have really said, shiyer metaltzel and koshul yotza ben chorin. And therefore, we can't learn from there about karka in general. Really, there the word karka doesn't belong there. It should have said metaltzelin. Now they have to explain, if it should have said metaltzelin, why did it say karka? I did itani resha, Rabbi Akiva Omer, karka koshu chayeve pepeal bibikurim, but lechtova lam pruzva, but lechnoti mam nechasim shen lam achoyut, kesep shtarwa hazachka. Because the Mishnah, now it's two Mishnayot before, that's why I wanted you to see the slew of the Mishnayot, but because the Mishnah started this whole topic with karka koshu chayeve pepeah, once they had that phrase, karka koshu, which there it's obviously only referring to karka, you're not chayeve pepeah, and bikurim on metaltalim, right? It's not even relevant. Since the Mishnayot, the slew of Mishnayot, started with the word karka, so when it got to the karka koshu of the shiur karka koshu, they used that phrase that was floating around in the recitation of the Mishnayot also, especially. If you view that we believe that they passed on the Mishnayot, it seems pretty clear, Baal Peh. So often they use the same Lashon to remember it. It's easier to remember the Mishnah if you have all the same Lashon. But not that that word was specifically used because it was trying to say karka and the karka means metaltalin. No. The word karka that was used, it could have used the word metaltalin. Okay, and therefore, wait, let's just finish the end. Mishum hachi katane karka. Okay, and therefore it says karka. Okay, and then we'll get to tomorrow about the kol shehu. Okay, so that was about the karka issue. So just to review the flow, we had Rabbi Zeira, who said that he liked Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yirmiyah's position about that it's karka or metaltzelin kedei parnasato. Rabbi Yosef, who says, I don't know why you like that position. It doesn't match the words in the Mishnah. Abaye supports Rabbi Zeira and says, no, it can't work in the Mishnah because karka, we proved from Peah, could mean metaltzelin. And Rabbi Yosef rejects his proof and says, hey, what do you mean? The word karka, they really wasn't specifically karka. It really meant to say metaltzelin. But they used karka because that's the word that was being used in that slew of Mishnayot. Okay, and therefore one can't learn from here. This is a unique case where really the word metaltzelin should have been there. It's not for a side reason, but it doesn't teach you about karka in general. Generally, when we do say karka, we mean karka. Mm-hmm.